To the very first in the TWT Creative Precinct Public Programs and Bridging Hope Charity Foundation programs. We are actually taping this tonight, so it's available on podcast on the Bridging Hope Charity Foundation website. So we just, we take what we do very, very seriously, and my daughter, who is in the audience, knows the credo, do it once and do it well. So from our very first talk, we wanted to make the audio work. So I don't worry, this is 16 point, so it's not pages and pages. What we're going to do is be in conversation, and we really want to activate Q&A afterwards, so any questions that you have, please do be very vocal with them. Who would have thought we were going to meet in St. Leonard's to discuss art, ever? So this is really the beginning of the St. Leonard's Creative Precinct. It has been activated by James Winter at Brandex through TWT Property Group, and we've taken it kind of to another level too. Without announcing the names, one of Australia's best known artists other than Alex is taking that studio space next week. Two artists are going to be downstairs, and there'll be six more activating another building that we have in Atchison Street, St. Leonard's, and that's really the start of everything, and it's terribly, terribly exciting. I remember coming here when I worked at Art in Australia magazine in Chando Street, St. Leonard's, just going, whoa, why is an art magazine here? So it's actually very exciting to kind of keep that tradition going, but turbocharged. I will say something about Bridging Hope Charity Foundation. I'm the curator, and what am I? Curator and something. Because you probably don't know what it is, nor TWT Property Group. I am here because of Tina Tian's commitment to the visual arts, and she's come in and gone out again. Tina Tian founded Bridging Hope Charity Foundation in China in 2013. And the Australian arm was founded in about February of this year. Anka Tim is the manager. Ariel Zhang has a title still to be determined because it keeps on growing. But the real aim is to give back to local and national and international communities. The pervading theme is really well-being. Tina is very concerned with that. And the two pillars are mental health and the visual arts. And Bridging Hope Charity Foundation is the principal supporter for the Biennale of Sydney this year, the Big Anxiety Festival, and we are going to announce, but it's already been put on the website for UNSW Art and Design. We are principal supporters of the annual for the next 5 years, and also going to support a very important prize, yearly prize. On the mental health side, a feasibility study has been conducted to deal with mental health issues in the Mandarin-speaking communities in Australia and throughout China, developing apps, doing a whole bunch of different things that are really, really very exciting. So, sorry, I just wanted to. As a property developer, Ariel and I are involved with many artists sort of working on the many different properties, and it's not just about the 5% budget that you have to put into public art. It is, you know, about the numbers of the apartments being designed specifically. It's really New Life is the brand name. There are about six different developments that have broken ground in Sydney. This will be 1,000 apartments in St. Leonard's. There will be probably a satellite museum. There will most certainly be our permanent artist studios and a lot of educational activation. So I want to thank Tina in absentia, wherever she is now with her children, for her vision and to be part of this very exciting team. In welcoming you all tonight, we'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, who are the Gurungai people, and Kuringai is sort of related to that, on whose land we now sit, literally, and pay our respect to the elders past and present and our working lives together in going into the future on this really fantastic land. It's excellent to see a few emerging artists here tonight who I know, and there are probably others who I don't know who are here. You've just smiled, so you're probably in that. Thank you. We hope you'll glean something about the profession of being an artist from one of Australia's great professional artists. And here to share their experiences are Brianna Munting, has been NAVA's deputy director, I'm reading this, for the past 7 years and previously held the positions of curator for Kashula Powerhouse, Art Center, and assistant curator at Gallery 4A. Brianna's work is focused on highlighting and valuing the arts and arts practitioners who generate innovation, inspiration, and social change, and she continues to promote projects, as I know very well, that inspire the visual arts. And you're currently undertaking a PhD at Sydney College of the Arts, which, what's happening there? But that's another story. That's another, yeah. I'm actually on the advisory council for UNSW Art and Design. So, yes. Yeah. Delwyn Everard is a lawyer, arts advocate, strategic thinker, and the founder of Everard Advisory, a boutique and very affordable legal firm focusing on the arts. For the years prior, Delwyn was deputy director of Australia's National Community Legal Centre for Arts Law, managing its legal advice service. And Delwyn is on the board of Art Month, where we met many years ago, and has worked extensively with Indigenous art centres in remote Australia, assisting with governance and business advice. Thank you for being here. And Alex Seaton is a multidisciplinary artist who works in sculpture, photography, video, and installation, best known, I guess, for his use in marble carving. Recent work has used his lens reflecting the contemporary, this is from your studio assistant, which not all artists have studio assistants, but Alex does. Really working with the language of classical statuary and engaged directly with contemporary political issues. With too many solo exhibitions to name, including the Kochi Muzuri's Biennale in India, Galleries Paris-Beijing, awarded the Grand Jury Prize at the Fondation François Schneider, inaugural Nancy Fairfax Artist in Residence, Margaret Olley Art Center, prestigious residency at Art OMI in New York, and in the Adelaide Biennial, Alex is undoubtedly one of Australia's leading and most respected contemporary artists. And as I said before, I'm very privileged to be the art advisor and curator to Bridging Hope Charity Foundation with Ariel Zhang, whose many, I guess, the years of experience have kind of led me here. I'm not going to talk more about this. Now onto the conversation. Alex, I'll start with you, being the artist. What differentiates, and then I want you three to really discuss this, a professional artist from a dabbler?
First of all, thank you very much for having me here. I wanted to say, first off, that industry-relevant discussions, I certainly feel, are really, really important at this moment in time. We've come from, certainly from my experience in the early 90s, graduating College of Fine Arts, what was then College of Fine Arts. looking and forward and knowing your options, had I known what I now know, I'd be far more relaxed about the idea of diversity of practice and what was possible. Knowing your options and having discussions with your peers is one of the best, most informative ways. And the industry doing it in a more formalized fashion, I actually truly applaud.
So having mentors, having people that you can discuss professional issues with?
Yeah, not to get away from your question about dabbling, but very importantly, I think for a whole bunch of reasons, I got very lucky. I know that in my experience, late 90s, graduating College of Fine Arts, there was a generation of younger collectors who were around who were enthusiastic for art coming straight out of the colleges, fresh. Remember, late 90s, the secondary market still dictated, was seen as an arbiter of whether you'd had any some sort of formal success, in inverted commas. And looking for mentors was really difficult and thin on the ground, if only because, for various different reasons, the generation above us had to fight for every opportunity in the 70s and 80s, and those were some of my lecturers in the early 90s, and they were preparing you for failure. They weren't preparing you for success. They were doing the classic art school scare. They were saying 5% of you will make it, or one in 100 of you will make it. That sort of scare tactic that didn't prepare you for ongoing success and a long-term career in the arts.
And Brianna, you're nodding. The whole thing of making it as an artist and rigor and practice, how would you...
I would say that as an artist, the biggest thing that skill, particularly for you guys, brave and courageous people, that you need, I get to not be an artist, so I don't need to be as brave, but is resilience. And the reason that I'm nodding is also about planning for success, because that's never really discussed as a concept. And yet, when you do look long term, there was this kind of idea that a career trajectory used to be you go to art school, you show in ARIES, you get picked up by a commercial dealer, then you might get curated into public galleries, and then you might get into big international shows or residencies as part of that. I would probably argue nowadays that does not exist. That traditional career path is not there anymore. What does exist is artists making the choice on where they want their work to be, where they want their work to show, and moving much more project to project basis.
How does a 21-year-old know that?
Okay. This is my other big thing, is I am an inherent believer in research. Research, research, research. Research comes from conversations. Research comes from having studio spaces, collaborating with peers. Research comes from going and seeing almost everything, particularly when you're young. I remember, and I don't know if you guys feel the same, but when I started out, there were moments where you're going to 4 exhibition openings a week. And when you're just starting, it's really, really nerve-wracking to do that. I'm going to step through into a gallery space and I'm not going to know anyone, and am I going to be this weird person in the corner that everyone's looking at? So many people feel the same. You do have to be a little bit brave, a bit courageous, and talk about your ideas, listen to people, just start up a general conversation, and it will be amazing what can come from that as well.
And drink gallery wine.
Yeah, you do build up a resilience to really bad wine.
And Delwyn, as an arts administrator and lawyer, you would see things from the other side. I mean, we discussed earlier that a very well-known gallerist sort of said, oh, I should have been on that panel because I could have offered the kind of gallerist thing. And I said, oh, so how do you work with artists? And this, I'm not going to mention the gallery, but it is one of Australia's top 3. And I said, you know, in the contracts, and said, oh, no, we don't deal with contracts. We don't have contracts with our artists. We trust each other so much. And Delwyn's comment was,
well, my advice to the artist was to run. I think, you know, one of the things about being a professional is that it's not a place that you eventually arrive at when suddenly success finds you. I think it's about, you have to own it yourself. So it is about resilience, and it's about respecting your own work and not giving it away, or if you do things for free, you make a careful, considered decision as to why. Is it good for you? What are you really getting out of it? And I see, as a lawyer, I mean, I guess, you know, a lot of people come to me for help because something's gone wrong. So it's possible that I'm unduly pessimistic. If things are going
realistic,
really well, you know, people don't ask me questions.
So, Delwyn, can you give some examples or an example of something that comes to mind of a situation that an artist has been in and they've come either to you at Arts Law or you now?
Yeah, well, endless examples. I mean, examples of artists who've been commissioned by councils to do things and things haven't gone swimmingly for one reason or another, not actually their fault, but they end up being sort of bullied by the people at the council who are employees and need to meet their KPIs and put pressure on people who they know will do anything to get their work out there and get it finished, and who say yes all the time, when at some point really maybe they should be pushing back and saying, well, actually I've done what I needed to do. You need to be part of the solution. It's not just on me. One very simple example is I acted for, a couple of art centres who came to me when the Aboriginal artists that they were looking after, they'd been approached to have images put in a coffee table book that somebody wanted to put out, you know, a wealthy collector wanted to put out this book. and they received a letter that said, look, we'd really like to put these images of these works in our book. It's going to be really fabulous. You know, it'll really promote your work. You're lucky to be in the book. We'd like you just to waive the copyright fee and, you know, this is a great opportunity for you. And I had more than one person come to me about this same one. And the advice I said was, well, actually, just remember they need you. So I suggest you write back and say, actually, these artists, especially some of them, are actually now quite elderly and their copyright's a valuable thing that the law has given to them. And they're painting less. They need that now.
And the copyright fee is not that high.
Absolutely. And so unfortunately, no, we're really sorry. If you're not able to provide a fee, we actually can't accept to be in your book because...
Alex.
Can't do it for free. And what happened was immediately they got the letter back saying, oh, actually, well, we can find a fee. Because, of course, without the pictures, there's no book. There isn't. But people's artists, I find, are very often a little bit too trusting. They are generally much nicer people than lawyers. So they say yes more often and... They're very easily convinced it'll be great for me because they're not valuing themselves enough. I mean, I think about being professional where we started is about you've got to respect yourself and respect your work, know that it's got value and treat it that way.
Alex, you were wanted to comment about the book.
Oh, yes. All the time. That experience happens all the time.
Still.
But I think more that Delvin's comment speaking to artists not knowing their power. I don't know if I'm being naturally gifted to be more suspicious. I'm lucky to be suspicious, but I read my contracts. And quite often, I mean, it was a very prestigious competition quite a few years ago now, won't name it, but they tried to sign get the artist to sign when they did their entry, the copyright over in perpetuity to the institution. And fuck that. I rang around 50 of my friends who were all entering the same thing, and we got it changed. They immediately backed out, not even a second. Like, and we have so much power collectively, as is why I'm so enthusiastic about industry talks. We talk, we understand what our powers are. We, in fact, you know, the baseline is exactly as Delwyn says. They need us more than we need them.
When, as a practicing artist, did you realize that yours was a business? Like any other business, really, though, yeah. You know, obviously the core of an artist is very different, but...
Sure. It was the only thing my parents said when I said, I want to be an artist. And that's maybe a gift of some kind from them, because they were always terrible at handling money.
They weren't artists. They're not artists.
No, yeah, they're in IT. and they just say, oh, to be an artist is to be self-employed. Let me show you how to invoice. Now, that was the first awareness of that. For me, I'd never had a good shape or sense of what that was. I mean, to answer the dabbler question, I dabble. I dabble a lot of things. And I'm still a dabbler. However, what it leaves my studio, what I choose to release in the world to an audience at large, I consider my very tight professional practice. And knowing that I defend that in every which way, I have a fairly costly practice, as in ideas that require a bit of investment. So I have
because
been
of the
very
material you
because
work
of the materials,
in.
Because of the scale sometimes. And I realized that I would need to defend that end of things very early. So I was doing my own tax returns and reading up on GST legislation when that was coming up and things like that.
That's why you could understand a contract.
But the idea that these asks, you would see it time and time again, these asks that are just egregious. The amount of times that I've seen these public commissioning contracts that have not been updated since 2005 when I was first an arts student at College of Fine Arts. We'd be looking at this magical figure, I've complained about it a lot on social media, in fact, $200,000. We want a major gateway artwork for our municipality and we want it to be significant and long-lasting for 20 years, plus would you mind doing the installation cost and that, the engineering surveys? They have not left nothing for the artist
for
as
the
a
fee.
Mm. Or they've rolled it in so the artist must look to savings within the production cost in order to even eke out a living there. They're asking, in essence, we're not updating any of these contracts for cost of living and normal interest rate rises and things like that. They're asking you to fund their major production, and it comes again and again and again.
And if they take the time, which can be 2 or 3 years to do it, your original agreement cost is the one that you have to stick to, where if you think about all the other industries, a quote is usually valid for a set amount of time. The expectations is that an artist quote can be valid for it in perpetuity. But I've seen some horror ones where they're like, can you please insure the public artwork for 25 years or more as the artist, not as the organisation. Reading contracts, excellent skill to have, or having people like Delwyn read them, or even talking to Nava, we are kind of that first base where can people go, oh shit, I'm in trouble, what the hell do I do? I strongly recommend you call us because we can at least point you in a direction or advise
Brianna,
you.
I think, you know, there might be people in the audience who don't know
what Nava is.
Let
me backtrack.
And, yeah.
So Nava is the National Association for the Visual Arts. We are like a union, but are not a union. We are the peak body for visual arts, craft and design. We're a membership organisation, so we do rely on people to be members, and that's how we function at the moment. We provide insurance. If you're ever working with local government, we provide pretty cheap public liability insurance. It's kind
so
of
as a member artist,
as
NABA.
A member artist, you get it covered for up to $20 million. It fits with all of the requirements that local government has. We also can advocate on your behalf. So when you may not have a contract and something goes wrong, or you've entered a studio agreement and something goes wrong, we can often go in and help you negotiate. We also have the code of practice, and this is the document that basically allows you to push, this is the way that I frame it anyway, it allows you to push back if you think there are unfair rules without worrying about being personally punished. Because you can say, well, NAVA's code of practice says this is the benchmark for the visual arts sector, whether it's around fees, whether it's around public commissions, whether it's around copyright. It really gives you that negotiating tool as well. But I've just done this little plug for my organisation. Apologies, but
How many artists are members of NAVA?
Professional artists, we have paid membership. I think it's a little over 4,000.
Fantastic.
And we have a readership of about 25,000. So we are a national org, so we're connected nationally within each state and territory. I flew up from Tasmania today to come and do this. So it's kind of regular connections that we are able to make as well.
I encourage everyone to join. I've been a member since, I think, 1996. And sometimes I haven't been able to pay my dues, but they've been very kind and sent the material anyway. But knowing your options, knowing the resources that you have, there are a lot more resources than you initially realise.
Yeah, we do everything from tax to ABNs to invoices, all those templates, instead of rewriting the wheel, just how come to us, really. It's kind of a little bit of a cut-through pathway to it.
Well, that's why you're speaking tonight. It's really about professionalizing your practice and really getting down to the nitty-gritty and the nuts and bolts, to use cliches. I'm just thinking that, you know, we do have people on the floor who might want to ask questions rather than...
to the members as the professional artists, mm-hmm. and I think that's a bit of an area that's not always clear about whether you're an emerging artist or a professional artist. I recently entered an art prize and you had to just say which there were different categories.
Mm-hmm.
I put myself as an emerging and someone pointed their finger at me because they said, why are you that? And there were all different answers. Was it to do with whether you had an ABN or whether you, how many years you'd been out of college, all those questions.
So we define professional for the purposes of the insurance and we define it using the ATO's definition, which basically is just that you're working towards being an artist through entering art prizes, through undertaking residencies, through having a website, through having an ABN. That's what we define professional as. Within that, So you can have another job, you can do, because really, let's be realistic, we all need to make money as well at some point. I currently do 3 or 4 jobs simultaneously, but that's professional. The other side of that question is, you'll never hear me use emerging. I'll always say early career, because I don't believe anyone is emerging to something. I think that you might be at the beginning, but emerging, there's a politic around it for me anyway. So you might hear early career, mid-career, or established artist. And those are very fluid definitions and are really dependent on the organisation or often the funding agency and what those parameters are for them. Early career is pre-5 years of practice, so your first 5 years of practice. And then once you start getting mid or established, it becomes quite blurry as well, because often mid-career can last for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and established is the same. We do set out our scales of fees and wages, so if you're ever writing a grant or you're ever wondering what you should be paid, our code of practice has a scales of fees and wages for that, and we set them with early, mid and established in mind, and that's with the understanding that if you are a well-established artist, you've worked, you've given your time in some ways, and so there needs to be recognition of that practice. But most people apply it loosely around that kind of first 5 years of practice and then later. Would you guys agree?
So what are you, Alex?
I'm a professional artist. I don't think I can get away with anything else. I have actually found the ATO to be very good with artists and what is set up. I think there's a lot of advocacy still to be done with the ATO, regards things like, I think we all still are applicable to a kind of 1970s definition of what an artwork costs to create. I think it's like a $500 threshold. That's nothing. That's laughable for anyone who's even bought Belgian canvas, Belgian linen recently. You'll be subject to capital gains if you try and donate that in the years to come, like when you're old and
dying. So the cultural gifts program.
$500 threshold is nothing. It needs to change.
Yeah.
The last time I think the legislation was written by Lowenstein's back in the 70s, and that needs updating. Even Tom Lowenstein, when I confronted him about it, it just socially.
Tom Lowenstein is an accountant to the artists.
Yeah. And a prestigious one, and has done some really good work in the arts in the past. But when jokingly confronting him about it socially, he said, "Oh no, there just needs to be a new generation. I'm retired." You know, there needs to be this new obviously update the legislation around the arts, and the true cost of everything is good arts advocacy, and we're learning that statistics really give us a much better picture. The Australian Council have started to re-examine that, as well as National Association for Visual Arts, which is great.
And the other thing with arts prizes as well is that they're taxable at the moment, and that's something that we're kind of taking on board, because a lot of artists have come to us and said, but, you know, when I win the Archibald, for example, Mitch, he still gets only, I think it's 80% of that prize money. So whilst people go, oh my God, look how much the artist is earning, it's actually significantly less once you put tax in. And yet so many other prizes or scholarships for other areas are tax-free. So we're really looking at how we use those benchmarks to apply that to the arts as well.
And what's interesting about a prize is you may have worked towards that for many years, and then the prize all dumps down in one tax year, as if it's been earned just for that one artwork, when in fact, in terms of your own career, you're probably seeing that as something you've been working towards over a long period of time. So it's difficult being an artist when you bump up against a tax system that's really it's really designed for people who get told what to do 9 to 5 and don't have that. You know, they aren't self-employed or working at a career in the same way.
And you can play the numbers and the horses and earn something like $20,000 untaxed without that ever being an issue, yet I'm taxed from the very first dollar, although I might win in an art competition. It is truly unfair, and there's a lot of work to still do. But I have a question about In my experience, institutions can be some of the first people to violate
some of your recommendations about your, sorry.
No.
The recommendations about what artist fees should be.
But institutions, you mean public museums and galleries?
Publicly funded galleries.
No, I understand the idea of opportunity costs, but there is such a thing as leading from the front.
Yes. No, absolutely. This is something that we're actually grappling with now. We did a big survey at the end of last year and actually asked institutions what they pay Australian artists, because there is a big difference you'll find with what institutions pay international artists and what they pay Australian artists. And we did an update of our fees to actually make sure that from artist-run initiatives to CAOS, which is contemporary arts organisations, to majors could afford to do that. We do get calls from artists on what their fees are being paid, particularly by some major institutions.
By fees, for those who don't quite understand, it's sort of a commissioning fee or a loan fee or a copyright fee.
The example you use on the book, we've advocated for artists with major institutions who have used images of works that are held in collections but have not actually notified the artist that they're using this for a range of marketing materials as well. So we often will then speak to the institution, we'll negotiate fees on behalf of the artist, provided they're members. We're going about to go through this process where we are going to assess whether institutions pay fees at NAVA rates, and there's a kind of sticker that we've produced, which is like a code of practice supporter sticker. So if you do pay at those rates, we'll be giving people electronic access and physical access to those, so we know which galleries are paying
to the
heart,
like the heart check for food.
Yeah, because our our expectation is that these benchmark rates, if you are publicly funded, you need to put a percentage of your budget aside to pay artist fees. That should happen first and foremost.
Yeah.
Because so many conversations that we have, and this is not my own words, I'm going to quote someone else, but everyone else in the room gets paid except for the artist.
Well, you know, it's interesting. That goes to, you know, the whole thing about being an early career artist or mid-career artist or very established. And the pinnacle really is to have a really good gallery representing you and being your advocate and getting you into art fairs and getting you into museum shows. But they now sometimes take 60% and the artist gets 40. And the artist has to pay for framing for their shows and blah, 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 blah. So how... what's your comment as an artist?
I've got a lot to say about this particular topic. If we're talking about commercial representation... No, there's a particular... I know I talk a lot, but there is there's a lot on this, because I, for one, have just had a couple of forays into international commercial galleries, and my experiences with them have been utterly joyous. Australian commercial galleries, this is a generalisation, please take this as a generalisation, but because there are some really great ones, and there's some really terrible ones, and I'm with an excellent one. Generally are on a consignment model. They do not actually represent their artists. They don't do the necessary work in the background to represent you and advocate for your work and articulate your work to a wider population, let alone the institutions and the curators that need to be aware of your work. I find that the... you know, it's actually only a smaller handful of galleries that have gone to a 50-50 model, and there's only a very tiny amount that have gone to 60-40.
But it's still, I mean, even in private equity and banking, you would never do a deal with 60-40. It might be 10 to 15%.
But that's
right.
But also on arts prizes, commissions on top of that, and we've also had instances of public art commissions, the fee, a percentage of that fee having to go to commercial galleries.
Well, what we're involved with here is that you do the budget and everything else, and then the gallery takes at least 40% of the artist's fee that's part of the budget, and you just think that's not right for the artist.
And I'm just sort of, as a lawyer, popping in there to sort of say that that's where we get back to the contract. You know, I think a lot of artists... don't like dealing with the paperwork, and don't really want to think about the business side, because that's not nearly as much fun as being in the studio and, you know, doing the thing that you love doing the most. Now, that's great if you want to be a dabbler, which is where we started.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm guessing that of all of the artists in this room, most of you would like to earn a living from your art and not and give up the other job, whatever it might be. I'm right. Exactly. So then you have to be a bit more businesslike about it, and you have to be in a professional way. If you're a pushover, you will be pushed over. You know, if you don't read the contract, you will be the one who ends up with a contract that doesn't work for you. And if you're nervous about that and feel more comfortable without a contract because you don't like looking at the printed page and working out what it all means and are too intimidated even to ask the question, you're dealing with the wrong person. If you don't want to ask them questions, and there's something wrong with the relationship right from the beginning. So you have to, you know, when we're talking about galleries, you know, do your homework, your research. You want a contract because it's there to protect you. Not having it means that you're giving yourself over completely and trusting the other side to do the right thing, which is not businesslike. It's not professional. And you will be treated with more respect when you yourself, I think, act in a professional way and ask questions. And I often say to artists, well, you know, if you go back and say, actually, I can't sign this today, I need to think about it for a couple of nights and I want to get some advice on it, that's actually a really savvy response. If the offer disappears, how lucky are you that you asked that question? Because if they take it away because they don't want you to read the contract, you probably shouldn't have been, they're not the right people to be dealing with. So it's about, you know, being a little bit smart about it and not grabbing the first thing that comes along. And if it's not right for you, it's not right for you. And if you don't understand it, then you are putting yourself in a really vulnerable position.
And 90% of the disputes that we deal with, the first question we ask is, do you have a contract? And 99.9% of the time, the artist says no. And that's where you also haven't laid out your set of expectations, because when you've laid out a contract, you understand what you have to deliver and you also understand what they're going to deliver. And that's really, really important.
Well, I think with TWT and Bridging Hope, we're very aware of best practice, and any contracts that we go into are really diligently executed with a lot of discussion from both sides.
And the other aspect to a contract, of course, is that you review it regularly. With commercial galleries in particular, say representation, it's a very intimate relationship. They get to know your work, where your thinking is at. They can best advocate for you in that way. So the best gallerist is taking the time to understand you, taking the time to understand your ideas, how they're going to develop, where your life conditions are at. You may not be able to commit in the next 12 months to these large, major, say, commissions that they may have gone and got you, because your life circumstances have changed. You're busy maybe raising a child or whatever it may be. That relationship is constantly updated and grows, and the intentions of the gallerist to either stay around or stick around changes as well. We see so many comers and goers in the art world promising all kinds of, you know, large and wonderful things, but not actually able to deliver. So the best advice I have for any artist trying to find a good gallery is someone you actually can talk to. Someone you can talk to really frankly, really honestly about your concerns, but making sure that when time comes, you feel really comfortable to say, no, I just can't do that. I can't afford to do that, or this is what it takes to make my work. I have to articulate what it takes to make my work in order to get the best deal for it, because otherwise, I'm just funding them, and that's certainly nothing I can do.
Mm. Are there any other questions from artists on the floor?
Can I ask you guys one?
Yeah.
What have any of you thought about, okay, I ask this because I teach as well, where you want to be in 5 years' time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've just done a plan for 5 years, and I know it's going to change.
Yeah. You won't.
I'm absolutely certain it's going to change. But in 5 years' time, I actually hope to have been able to cut out enough time in my schedule to just work on one project for more than 12 months.
That is an amazing
luxury. This is ideal, and I know it's a luxury, but it does actually mean that I'm actually budgeting for that now.
Yep.
I'm saving up for basically a sojournment into my creative heart. But like, I don't know if I can do that yet.
Yep.
But that is my ultimate goal. Because certainly in the commercial gallery sector, the pressure to produce had to be pushed again and again creatively. Like, oh, what have you done for us lately? Literally is the rule. Or it's quick and the dead. There's so many others rushing into the content sphere to fill it up for you that even your gallerist will move on. And it's sometimes you can get suckered into to producing all the time, and it's not always going to get the best out of you. Carving out the time and the schedule very carefully into the future means you really defend your practice very well.
And I think Alex has also kind of answered the reason why I wanted to ask that question, because you make decisions now on where you want to get to as well. So even if it's as simple as I want to have 3 exhibitions at these places in the next 5 years, you actually make decisions on how you do that now with your practice to get there.
And it's like doing a business plan and a strategy in anything else, in any other realm professionally. And I think it is about artists really seeing themselves as very committed professionals that have a calling too. It's a bit of a kind of...
vocation.
It's a vocation. But with so much competition and so many, I mean, even though I am on the advisory council of one of the most extraordinary faculties, there are a lot of artists that are disgorged every year. And where do these people go, especially in Australia? You know, we do have a small population, so I think it is about always having a vision and really, really keep researching and keeping yourself informed.
And the other thing is, know what to say yes to and know what to say no to, because you don't have to say yes to everything. And often, like, burnout is a real issue for artists and arts administrators and arts workers, and it's about managing your time really smartly. An artist friend of mine always said, we were talking about grants, and if any of you have written a grant, they can be kind of laborious a lot of the time. And she was like, well, I could spend a week on a grant, or I could go get some casual work that's going to give me the same amount that the grant is and let me produce my work and maximize my studio time. So it is always about weighing up also what's going to give you what I think is studio time or dream space, and being able to just work out what to say yes to and what to say no to.
But it's also that thing on your CV of, you know, which grants have you received, which prizes have you been a finalist in. So it is constantly weighing up.
Yeah, what is it worth to you? And that doesn't even remotely mean necessarily economic.
Mm.
Yeah, the amount of time you can spend on any one EOI, expression of interest. You know, there's been a constant complaint amongst, say, commissioning. By the way, I actually don't do commissions, so this is not my field. This is a complaint from a lot of my friends, is that, you know, we're really not paid very well, or artists generally aren't reimbursed very well to develop the initial application. The actual content basically goes unpaid for. And it's very rare that you'll have a development fee rolled into a lot of the commissions. Say, for instance, I'm at the moment just being ambitious for my practice, even though I don't even remotely expect to do it. I'm going to put in a Venice application as an expression of interest.
Woo!
I don't expect to get it, but I want to be ambitious for my practice. I want to think big and challenge myself to think big. It's worth it to me to at least see if I can think in those terms.
Yeah.
But I don't remotely expect to get it. But sometimes it's worth taking the week, 2 weeks out to practice to just focus on that project as a pie in the sky.
But that's looking at your strategy for the next 5 years and is Venice something I would like?
Yeah, it's based on asking those questions of my practice. Is this going to be the right kind of venue?
Yeah.
And do I have ideas that are suitable to that venue?
Is Venice right?
Arguable.
I was just going to add that, you know, if you say yes to everything, then when the big opportunity comes along, you'll be too busy to take it. But more importantly, you know, I've looked at a few sculpture big public commission contracts, and talking to the artist, it's become clear that there's money for installation and engineering and materials, and you know, nothing, as you say, in it for them. So it's almost like their time and their creative energy is valued at zero, which is really interesting. Yeah. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't necessarily take that opportunity at a different point in your career. So sometimes saying yes to that is a springboard, but it's important to, every time you say yes, it has to be eyes wide open. You have to have sort of weighed up, okay, so if this is not really going to, you know, maybe compensate me in the way that NAVA thinks I should be compensated for my time, you know, I'm going to do it anyway. Why is that? A, because I really want this opportunity. It will give me profile and platform. It will enable me to maybe to work with somebody else that I really want to work with and don't otherwise have that opportunity. So you weigh up all those factors. You don't just say yes because it was the next thing that came along.
Yeah. Mm. Please.
Hello.
I'm interested
James.
I'll be transparent. I started out, I am still a self-employed individual, but I have two full-time staff. That was the biggest leap. So working my way backwards, I've always sat on a cusp. If you look at, and this is in discussion with your accountant, if you look at the ATO rules, it all depends on your earnings, whether something like a PTY LTD is worth it to become Alex Eaton Studios rather than Alex Eaton the individual. If only because I don't really do public commissions. It's about limiting your liability, that setup. I think if I get any bigger, I would definitely go to that model, simply because doing payroll and that sort of thing becomes easier. My mainstay of my income still comes from commercial sales. The regional gallery circuit, they're actually one of the best payers around. They're really, really excellent. So my shows with them have always been well paid.
Do they give you an artist fee?
Yep. Well above the industry standards sometimes. You know, unlike some of the larger institutions who won't even pay them. In fact, it's my experience, a lot of the smaller arts bodies are really good at sticking to the guidelines. Really, really good. But look, long and short of it is basically commercial sales have worked very well for me. I found a gallerist that I can work with very closely who understands my practice and makes exceptions for me. And that's the thing. You don't take blanket anything. You negotiate with them about the nature of your practice. If you need them to bring down their rate, you ask them to. The status thing pretty much has remained unchanged. The biggest hurdles for me were to bring on help, to know what to pay them. I actually talked to NAVA at the time to know what the base rates were, what was a good rate, but also to be able to talk to, in fact, I've got an assistant, production assistant, who is an upcoming artist himself. He's also a friend, coincidentally, and we talked about where he'd like to be within that picture of 5 years, so that I could understand what I could offer him, facility, in kind, access to the whole workshop and all that sort of thing, so we grow together. I know that talking to senior artists above me who've had a practice where they have gone PTY LTD has worked very well, but it's when they need to bring on much bigger staff, for large projects and tight deadlines and that sort of thing. For me, temporarily or even concertedly over, a large period of time. Those are the real benefits. But it really comes down to the numbers of the earning of the studios, whether that's really something for you. It's allowed flexibility. I think once you get into, is my understanding, because I've really put everything back into my practice. That's why I'm here. But I think once, you know, you choose to, I don't even have family or children, but once you get assets, there's huge implications about, and because the idea of a legacy and what you're leaving behind, possibly for a family. Company structure does afford you protections that are well worth paying attention to. I just haven't personally availed them for myself. A distance from, particularly if you work in the public sphere, with public commissioning, there's a huge amount of liabilities there if something goes wrong. And the company structure can also protect you in that way.
And the same if you're managing a space. That's often at the point, as you would know, where you might need to consider incorporated association to give you that space between yourself and any also potential liabilities. I think that's really important. One of the other things, and I think Delwyn can actually talk better than I can, so I'm not going to talk about that very much, but in terms of considerations for when you do either manage a space or look at becoming an incorporated organisation, we were working with an artist-run initiative who'd lost their incorporation at some point, and so we ended up having to take over an auspicing role to be able to maintain them, and that's really important. The other one is, I know I had friends who were running an artist-run printing company, and they did really well one year, which meant they earned over $75,000. There's a GST cutoff of $75,000. So what that meant was they basically had to go back over their entire year's sales and add GST and work out how to pay the GST and recharge GST to people. So whilst you might think now I'm never going to need GST, it can happen where you get in financial difficulty if you haven't budgeted for that. If you've got a big public art commission, you may need to consider registering yourself.
That just sounds like a terrible mess to me. So, for because legally, once there's the cutoff point means that you must, as a matter of law, charge the GST. So if you've thought, oh, I don't need to worry about that, and you've madly just wandered along and you've charged a whole lot of people, let's say $1,000 each time for various different services, whether they're printing services, and then you've had a great year, you actually have to go back and find each one of those clients, issue a new invoice, add the GST on and collect it. Or alternatively, you're just liable to pay the government for all the GST that you forgot to collect. So I can imagine that being really difficult. The other, one of the benefits of GST, so you could choose to register for it even before you get to that threshold. And the benefit of that is that you can then claim back the GST that you spend on all your materials and equipment. So if this printing business, for example, if they had bought equipment and inks that might have been, say they bought $20,000 or $30,000 worth of equipment, ink, paper, whatever, that would have incurred GST of around $2,000 or $3,000. If you'd registered for GST, the government will actually, and you'd only earned $10,000 at that point, you'd charged your GST on it of another $1,000. So you'd only collected $1,000 of GST. You're probably not following along, but in terms of all the money that you'd spent on your bits and pieces, you'd actually had to pay $3,000 of GST. Mm. You can actually file a GST, it's called a BAS statement, with the tax office. They'll deposit $2,000 in your bank account. That's the way it works. You know, so they weigh up the GST you've collected on the services you've provided or the art you've sold, and they look at your list of all the GST you had to pay, and then they net it off, and you either pay them the difference or they pay you the difference. So even if you're earning under that threshold, for some arts practitioners, that may be valuable to you. So that's part of being professional, actually, thinking about those different business models and thinking about how much you're spending every year on equipment, and you know,
anything like that, and it might still be worthwhile for you to register GST.
And so who would you seek that? I'm just conscious of the time that we could probably natter on for quite some time, but who would one go to? An accountant?
You could go to an accountant, or, I mean, there is information on the ATO's website.
Yeah, it's not just in plain English.
Just quickly, the one other thing about liability that Brianna was talking about, often people don't want to incorporate because it costs a little bit of money to set up. And so a group might decide, well, we'll just run this studio together. If you are doing something in a group, running a business, some sort of business, you may be regarded as a partnership, which means that any one of you could be liable for 100% of the debts. So if you're operating a little RE space, maybe, let's say.
Artist Run Initiative, for those who don't.
You've agreed collectively to rent it, and you've got an agreement as to how you're going to fund that. And then something goes wrong, the owner of the building can just choose one of you to go after. You know, and if, you know, let's just say you are in a relationship and you've got a house and it's, you know, it's in joint names, that's your house. So if you think you might be in a partnership, it's very, you know, if you're in some sort of group business, really, really important to get legal and accounting advice.
Just to maybe temper a little bit of the scary parts of this that's going on here, is that the ATO is actually really good. We have a self-reporting system. If you think something doesn't sound right, ring him again. Ring him until you get the answer you want, and then do it your way. It's a self-reporting system, and you can always say, all right, I'll change it, I'll go back. I think arts accountants can be terrible. The larger ones get audited from time to time, because if you haven't noticed, the visual arts becomes a political kicking punching bag every now and then, and often that you get swept up in what is just scapegoating. It's often just better to go to your around-the-corner, average, you know...
Suburban accountant
who'll treat you like a regular business. Now, you'll tell him, no, I don't want to account for every drop of the metho. And he'll know the kind of accountancy you want to do. But the self-reporting is... And the ATO give good advice, and they're very good at understanding changing circumstance. So even I wasn't aware of this sort of threshold being able to be retroactively... But I do know that the ATO would give you special circumstances as long as you report that this was unexpected. This is how I did not expect to be taking this commission, but I need this for my opportunity. They're actually really good at understanding that and taking that into account. So there's no reason to be afraid.
I second that. We still call the ATO for questions we get from artists, and you do just keep calling if you don't get the right answer. Yeah. And as someone who doesn't understand tax but still can do my own tax, the ATO is great for that, and that is not my skill set, so it's okay.
As someone who's actually read the legislation around, say, you know, charities and gifts, it's really open to interpretation, and that's the point. My intention is very important there, and therefore my self-reported intention is very important and actually has a bit of weight. So I have to say, you know, if you're getting advice from your accountant that doesn't sound right, go to another one and just check.
Right, which, as you would with anything.
Yeah.
We really could keep on talking for a long, long time. If you want to come and ask these three wonderful panelists any questions privately, please do so. We'll be here for another couple of minutes. And I wanted to thank you all for coming to our inaugural public program. And thank, thank you. And Bridging Hope Charity Foundation is just an extraordinary entity to be involved with, as is TWT Property Group. It's the generosity is boundless, and the visions are extraordinary. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.